So July 23rd, 2018, in Ljubljana, Slovenia, reading from Bhagavad Gita, Chapter 2. Contents of the Gita summarized, text 16. I mean, all these verses are in poetry, but this is a particularly poetic, the Sanskrit here is particularly poetic. So, maybe some of you have the verse, we can chant it a couple times. Nasato vijjate bhavo. Na bhavo vijjate sata. Ubayor api dristontas. Twanayos tatvadarshibhi. Na. Never. Asataha. Of the non-existent. Vijjate. There is. Bhavaha. Endurance. Na, never, abhavaha, changing quality, vidyate, there is, sataha, of the eternal, ubayaho, of the two, api, verily, dristaha, observed, antaha, conclusion, two, indeed, anayaho, of them, tattva, of the truth, darshibhi, by the seers. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. Those who are seers of the truth have concluded that of the non-existent, or the material body, there is no endurance, and of the eternal, the soul, there is no change. This they have concluded by studying the nature of both. Purport. There is no endurance of the changing body, that the body is changing every moment by the actions and reactions of the different cells is admitted by modern medical science, and thus growth and old age are taking place in the body. But the spirit soul exists permanently, remaining the same despite all changes of the body and the mind. That is the difference between matter and spirit. By nature, the body is ever-changing and the soul is eternal. This conclusion is established by all classes of seers of the truth, both impersonalists and personalists. In the Vishnu Purana 2.12.38, it is stated that Vishnu and his abodes all have self-illuminated spiritual existence. Dotishmi Vishnur Bhuvanani Vishnuhu. The words existent and non-existent refer only to spirit and matter. That is the version of all seers of the truth. This is the beginning of the instruction by the Lord to the living entities who are bewildered by the influence of ignorance. Removal of ignorance involves the reestablishment of the eternal relationship between the worshipper and the worshipable and the consequent understanding of the difference between the part and parcel living entities and the Supreme Personality of Godhead. One can understand the nature of the Supreme by thorough study of oneself. The difference between oneself and the Supreme being understood as the relationship between the part and the whole. In the Vedanta Sutras as well as in the Srimad Bhagavatam, the Supreme has been accepted as the origin of all emanations. Such emanations are experienced by superior and inferior natural sequences. The living entities belong to the superior nature, as it will be revealed in the seventh chapter. Although there is no difference between the energy and the energetic is accepted as the supreme, and energy or nature is accepted as the subordinate. The living entities, therefore, are always subordinate to the Supreme Lord, as in the case of the master and the servant, or the teacher and the taught. Such clear knowledge is impossible to understand under the spell of ignorance, and to drive away such ignorance, the Lord teaches the Bhagavad Gita for the enlightenment of all living entities for all time. Nasato vijjate bhavo, na bhavo vijjate sata, ubayor apidristontas, twanayos tatvadarshi bihi. Those who are seers of the truth have concluded that of the non-existent, the material body, there is no endurance, and of the eternal, the soul, there is no change. This they have concluded by studying the nature of both. So I've always liked this particular verse of the Bhagavad Gita. I like the Sanskrit, na sato vijite bhavo, na bhavo vijite sata, those two lines. It's a very beautiful poetry, even if you don't understand the meaning. It's very beautiful in what we call a kind of parallel construction. Actually, the scriptures are full of all these sorts of literary ornaments. And Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says that without these sort of literary ornaments, there's no question of rasa, that to experience rasa, there has to be these sort of poetic literary ornaments, which we find here, spoken by the Lord himself. And in the translation, you also have this, of course, that of the non-existence, there's no endurance, and of the eternal, there is no change. So here we have sato and asata. So Prabhupada is explaining this in terms of the body and the soul, in terms of matter and of spirit. And then he goes on extensively in the purport to explain that there's a differentiation in spirit between the soul and God. So but let's look at this in a little bit of a broader sense. What does sat mean literally? Eternal. What else does it mean? Existence. What else? Truth. So all of these are the same. What exists, exists always and is always true. If something doesn't always exist as truth, then it's not really substantial. You know, basically Krishna is saying here, relative truths are not really truth. Now, we deal every day, of course, with relative truths. We have to. We're in a relative world where relative truths allow us to function. You know, I'm sitting on a chair. That's a very relative truth. I'm not always sitting on a chair. This is not always a chair. And as Prabhupada's explaining in the purport, this body that I have is constantly changing. So I'm identifying the body of this moment with me, but 20 years ago, this body didn't actually exist. And so it would be something different. So this is a relative truth. It's not an eternal truth. So I have to function like that with relative truths. It's not that we can only function with something that's absolutely truth. So why is Krishna trying to distinguish here between what is temporarily true but doesn't really have any substance to it and what is always true? Because although on a practical day-to-day level in this world, we do have to deal with relative truths, our interest should be in what is always and absolutely true. I remember speaking to one person who is no longer so active in the Hare Krishna movement, still says, I'm a devotee, but not so active. And he said, well, I didn't like it that we were always talking about the absolute truth. He said, it always sounded very sectarian to me. No, it was just the height, not the light. But thank you. It's like, that's better. He said it sounded very sectarian to him, like we have the absolute truth and nobody else does. And I said, no, it's not like that. We're saying, what is it that is always true in all time and all circumstances for all people in all places? Of course, that is the last verse of the Chaturslok of the Bhagavatam, that one should search for this at all times and all places, for all people, in every circumstance. So there aren't very many things that are always true for everybody, all the time, everywhere, is there? Very many things like that? Are there very many things like that? So in modern society, They're propounding the global secular society. Those leaders are propounding that there is no such thing as an absolute truth. Everybody has their own truth. This is a modern philosophy. In technical terms, it's called actually postmodernism or post-positivism. That there's no one truth. Everybody has their own truth. Everyone sees the world differently. Everyone interprets the world differently. And everyone's truth is truth for them. Of course, that is also the case, that each person understands things differently from everybody else. But what is the irony of this philosophy is that they don't say this, but they are acting as our philosophy of having no absolute truth is absolutely true. That is the irony of this, of postmodernism and post-positivism. And of course, people who propound a post-positivistic or postmodernistic view, they don't think everything is equally good. They don't think everyone's relative truth is equally good. They don't think, you know, Nazism is equally good with every other truth. You understand? So they do have some concept of gradation and some concept of absolute. Because there is something that is absolutely true. But what is it that's absolutely true? That is spirit. It's not that we're saying we have the right belief and we have the right practice and everybody else is going to hell because we are absolutely right. That's not what we mean by the absolute truth. What we mean by the absolute truth is which is always true for everybody all the time, no matter what. Whether you are a human, whether you are a bug, whether you are old, whether you are young, whether you are, you know, peach-colored or brown-colored or purple-colored or whatever color you may be, or whatever language you may speak, or however you identify yourself, or whether you're in a horrible situation or a wonderful... Spirit is always true. And the other things in life that are not spiritual are never really true. Maybe for practical use, one has to say, this is a microphone. Okay. But it's not really a microphone. Before it was a microphone, it was something else. And it will be again in the future something else. Isn't it? Or like this chair. This is wood. So before this was carved like this, it was a tree. And before it was a tree, it was sunlight and water and earth. And someday, again, it will become, you know, if we burn it, it will again become sunlight and water and earth. And even that isn't permanent. At the end of the universe, it will become the pradhan. There won't be any earth. There won't be any sun. Even the modern scientists say this. So eventually, it won't even be any of those things. It won't even be the modes of nature. It won't even be atoms and molecules. So it's not true. It may look like it's a chair for a long time. It may be a chair for 20 years or 200 years. But it's not really truth. So we want to put our attention, and it's interesting, Krishna says here, that we can understand this just by studying the nature of both. I find this interesting. He's not saying here, you can understand this just by hearing from the scriptures or hearing from the sages, just by studying. There's actually many things which we can understand just with a little thought and observation. And he's using the word darshibihi, to pay attention. If we just pay attention, we'll see, oh, something keeps changing and something doesn't change. My sense of I doesn't change, but everything else around is changing. So if we connect ourselves, anchor ourselves, shelter ourselves to something that's always changing, what will happen? Is that a firm shelter? It's not a firm shelter, isn't it? And we find this in this world all the time. You know, in very demoniac governments, if you are faithful to the government, then when the new government comes into power, they will kill you for being faithful to the old government. So you think, I'm going to take shelter of the government, and the very fact that you take shelter of the government means you get killed. Or you can take shelter of a job, and then the company is finished. Right? You can take shelter of your husband, your wife, and they may leave you for a more attractive partner, or eventually they die. You may take shelter of your money, and then it may be gone. Some thief may take it, or the market may collapse. You take shelter of your body, and then one day you look in the mirror, and, you know, one day I looked in the mirror, and there was my mother looking at me out of the mirror, and it's like, how did that happen? You know, and now I look in the mirror, and it's my grandmother. How did she get in my mirror, you know? And so if we take shelter of the body, if we're thinking, any of you who are young, I'm sorry to disturb you. But, you know, if when you're young and strong and beautiful and you think, yes, I take shelter of my body, and one day it's like, where did it go? So if we put our shelter in the things of this world, if we put shelter in the changing forms of this world, we have to use them practically. But if that becomes our shelter, then it's gone. I think of it, you know, it's like you're connecting to something and then it sort of melts. You know, you're wrapping your rope around something and then it's gone. And you're like, I don't, what's the basis of everything that I've done? I really saw this clearly when my mother was dying. And she was in a home for old people. So many of the people there had some kind of Alzheimer's or dementia. And she didn't. Her body was finished, but her mind was good. And many of the people there, they couldn't remember anything. You know, you'd say to them, oh, are you married? And they go, yes. I don't know. I mean, they didn't know. And you ask them, you know, how many children do you have? I have two. I don't know. What did you do in your life? I don't remember. And it was just gone, you know. And sometimes the people who worked there, they would tell me, oh, this person was a famous singer, and this person was this, and this. And it was gone. It was just all gone. I thought of it like, you know, you're building castles in the sand. So again, we have to live in the world, but our shelter should be in the spirit. Our shelter should be in what's absolutely true, what is always true. And that should be mostly what we are looking for. So of course, if you're sitting in this room, you can say, well, I don't know why she's saying this. I'm already doing that. I'm doing that all day, every day. This is really boring. I don't, why is she talking about this stuff? Elementary. I already know I'm not the body. I already know spirit. I'm already looking for the absolute truth. But I'll tell you frankly, even when we come to the Hare Krishna movement, we get initiated, we're doing sadhana, we can forget. And we can again try to take shelter and try to think what is important is something that is not really very important. And this, having darshibhi, to be able to see what is important and what is not important. I was just asked when I was in Hungary, the GBC asked me to speak to some devotees who had left ISKCON for many, many years. And they had become very critical of ISKCON. And they had been publishing very critical things. And now they wanted to come back. And they had written a letter of apology to all the devotees and all the leaders. And they were asking to come back. So they were asking some of us to speak to them. So when I was speaking to them, they were saying, there's this thing, you know, even though they wanted to come back, so they were still telling me, there's this problem in ISKCON, and this problem, and this problem, and this problem. And many of the things they said were problems were actually problems. you know, not everything, but some of the things they said, I had to say, you're right. Actually, that is a problem. And you're right about that one, too. That actually is a problem also. And then finally I said, but you know, it doesn't really matter. Said, you're never going to find a society that is free from problems. Because he was saying, well, I'm thinking if I come back to ISKCON, I will fix all the problems. I said, good luck to you. I said, even if you fix some of those problems, there will be other problems. And I said, and we're a preaching movement. We're constantly bringing in new people from the outside. And everyone is bringing their own difficulties, right? I said, but it doesn't matter. Of course, we should try to fix things. I'm not saying, again, that we shouldn't. We have to deal with temporary things. But I said, here in ISKCON, you can achieve Krishna Prema. And I know many, many people in ISKCON who are achieving Krishna Prema. And that you can do. This person may have done this bad thing, and these people may be fighting, and this thing is wrong, and that thing is wrong, and we should try to fix them. But those are not absolute truths. That's not really our concern. We are here to develop love for the absolute truth. And sometimes we need to remind ourselves, why am I here? What am I doing? Because even here we can get caught up in other things. I was telling him the story of how Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati had one disciple who was a very expert manager, but was also had some personal ambition. And many of the other God brothers, God sisters, they would say to Bhaktisiddhanta, you know, this person, he has some personal motive. And Bhaktisiddhanta said, yes, I know. But still he was engaging him in doing some service. And after Srila Bhaktisiddhanta departed from the world, this person acted to take over some of the properties. And Srila Prabhupada said, he was chanting Hare Krishna thinking, I will get the property, I will get the property. He said, so Krishna gave him the property, but he didn't give him the mission. You understand? He just got a building. So even one can come and think, you know, I am here for some position, for some status, for some respect, for some, and Krishna may give you. If we're here chanting Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna, then Krishna may say, oh, you want this thing? Here, you can have it. So we shouldn't take for granted just because we've come and we've put on these clothes and tilak and we have the everything, that means, yes, everything I am doing is for the absolute truth. But we should examine. And generally, when we become disturbed, we were talking about this in the car, generally when we become disturbed, it is because we are becoming attached to something that is not the absolute truth. When I'm thinking, you know, why are people treating me this way? Why is this happening? And when we get emotional about it, I remember, I don't know how many of you know Burajan Prabhu, but he did an exercise with us once at a japa retreat, and he listed all kinds of things in life. And he said, write down a number from 1 to 5. What is the intensity of emotion you feel about this thing? The higher the number, the higher the emotion, negative or positive. And then he said, how many of you have 1, 5? You know, it's like 40 or 50 things. How many of you have any 4s? And then he looked at everybody and he said, why do you have any 4s or 5s about any of these things? And we were all kind of, oh. He says, these are all temporary things. None of these things that he had listed are actually eternal. So this we can, ourselves, we can see. As Prabhupada would say, you can gauge your advancement yourself, like you can tell if you've eaten enough. So this Krishna says, you can see. Darshibhi, you can see this truth yourself. We can judge this ourselves. Where is my attachment? Is it to the eternal or to the non-eternal? What is true or what is not true? I mean, this chair is true in the sense that it exists, but it's not true in the sense that it's not eternally a chair. Do you understand what I'm saying? It always exists, but not as this, not in this identity. That's constantly changing. So where is my shelter? Where is my emotional investment? I love that story when Krishna was in Kaliya and the residents are just practically dying because they had invested everything in Krishna. You know, other people are dying when the stock market goes down, right? So whether the stock market goes down, whether we have a house, if everybody in the whole temple is criticizing us, those are all temporary. They come and go. But what is that that is always there, that we can always depend on? So, I want to thank you very much for what an amazing welcome. I think one of the most amazing welcomes. Thank you. Thank you very much for having me. So, it's already 4 minutes over the time in big, bold letters that I'm supposed to end. But we could take one or two questions. Yes. I hope I was going slowly enough for the translation. Okay. Yes.
You spoke about this difference. But many times we could somehow object to this difference not being so important. People who speak about this usually have this worldly opulences like fame and I mean, relatively speaking, in ISKCON, for example, sannyasis, they are materially quite well off, they are people take care, they get money and things, and they speak about unimportance of difference between absolute, I mean, about the absolute truth being the only important. So I wanted to ask, I sometimes doubt that Jada Bharata is not sitting on the Vyasasan usually. So maybe this is my dirty vision or whatever, but sometimes doesn't sound credible, or could it be done in some different way, or do you understand what problem
I think
do
I
have?
Understand. Yeah. And if I understand, I'm very happy you asked it. Mm. I think what you're saying is that the people who say that the relative are not important are the people who have relative opulence, and therefore it's not really very credible. So if somebody has, you know, €1 billion and they say, oh yes, money is not very important, then you're going to say, well, that's easy for you to say. You have a whole lot of it. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's
right. Okay, so well, I'm going to take this very personally, since I am sitting here saying this. I know you're not criticizing me, but you are criticizing me. No, you are. It's okay. No. It's good. No. It's actually a good thing. The fact that you can say this here tells me that this temple is wonderful. That somebody feels that they have the courage to say something like that in a public meeting in front of everybody, and nobody is going to say, no more prasadam for you, Prabhu. You will say, don't you dare say that. Actually, when I used to teach Bhakti Shastri to the teenagers, I told them you have to come with very difficult questions. And I said, every class you have to bring three difficult questions. And I remember one of them said, oh, this purport, Srila Prabhupada is really criticizing Arjuna. How is Prabhupada not doing Vaishnava Aparad? So I said, very nice question. And she's now a second initiated devotee, very active in the movement. So, no, I appreciate that. And you're saying to me, yes, you came here, we had a big kirtan for you, we're throwing flowers at you, we're giving you the guru room, the sannyasi room, and now you're saying it isn't important. How can I believe you? So, just a little bit about myself, so that I will be credible to you. So, I was born in a very rich family. My parents had, they were multimillionaires and very famous also. And I got to see how that just because you have a lot of money and a lot of fame doesn't make you happy. I got to see that directly. And from the time I was very young, I said, I want to find God. Then I moved into the Hare Krishna temple and I moved in with one little box. You know, I slept in a room with 12 people and I had nothing. I didn't take anything from my family at all. I mean, I had like 3 saffron polyester saris that weren't real saris. They were just big pieces of cloth, very heavy cloth. To keep them on your head, you had to pin them like this with a safety pin. And then they would move like this. They weren't even real saris. And the border was just dirt because they were so heavy. They were dragging on the ground. They always had a gray border of dirt. But I was happy. I was happier with nothing. I mean, we really had nothing. You know, we didn't even have a bed. I mean, I think it's very interesting that as a vanaprastha, I'm given beds wherever I go, but even as a grahasta, we never had a bed. We always just slept on a sleeping bag on the floor. And in the morning, you roll it up and you wash the floor and you have a little box of something. But I was much happier chanting Hare Krishna with nothing than I was in the great big multi-million dollar apartment on Central Park West in New York City. So I've actually experienced that. And as a member of ISKCON, there was a time my husband wanted to start his own business, and he eventually did, but the first 2-3 times he didn't work out. It took a few times. And one time I remember he said to me, Urmila, can you count your money? So we counted our money and we didn't even have $1. You know, we had 73 cents. And then he said, okay, the only possession we had then was one computer. We didn't have anything else at all, like not even a piece of furniture. So he sold the computer and got a job. And then a few months later, he had enough money from the job to buy a house. And so sometimes we had and sometimes we didn't have. And so I've had and not had. But I haven't found that one is happier than the other. I found I'm happy if I remember Krishna, and if I don't remember Krishna, I'm not happy. And I was just talking to Audarya Chandrika about how difficult it's been to be a woman in ISKCON. So not here in Ljubljana, but for the first 10 years I was in ISKCON, I wasn't allowed to preach at all. Even though before I joined the movement, I was trained in debate and public speaking. I mean, I literally had a room full of trophies. I was the state champion. I was the district champion in public speaking and in debate. And they said, sorry, you're a woman, you cannot speak, just be quiet. And, you know, it was really heavy, actually. And, you know, there were 15 years I wasn't allowed to chant japa in the temple room at all. And so, you know, the men were in the temple room, the women were in a second classroom, and the women with children, which was me, was in a third classroom. I had to chant japa often in garages, you know, without heat in the winter with my baby and that weren't even clean. And we were given prasadam last. So first for the men, then the women without children, and then the women with children. You know, when the children are hungry and you're getting prasadam last, and the men get the pakoras and the women don't get any pakoras. So I went through that for a very, very, very long, long, long time. And sometimes I'm actually hesitant to accept any kind of respect, because there's a level on which it bothers me, actually. There's a level on which I don't like it. You know, I try to understand that no one's respecting me, they're respecting Prabhupada, that's all. It's not a respect for me. If I think it's a respect for me, I don't like it at all. But anyway, I've experienced both. I've experienced being treated like, I was told, I would go to Bhagavatam class and the speakers were erstwhile sannyasis. You know what that means? That means they're not sannyasis anymore. So the people were sannyasis who are no longer sannyasis. And they would say, all the householders are just dogs, especially if they have children. They are just useless. They have no place in the Sankirtan movement. And I would just go home and cry. So I have been in that situation for many, 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 many years. And then I'm in a situation, I come here and I'm respected. Don't think I'm respected to this extent in every temple. And then I've been in situations where I have absolutely nothing. And then I've been in situations where I have a lot. And I see that it's the eternal that's important, not these other things. I don't see that it's these other things that's the source of my happiness or distress, really. I hope that adds a little bit to my credibility. No, that's pretty, that's foolish also.
No,
I'm not perfect. But I'm just saying it's not, and you should understand that many...
Not perfect to answer, not perfect in absolute terms,
okay,
but perfect to answer the question. That's because you were in a quite difficult position, according, relatively to sannyasis, to man sannyasis. So
yeah.
That's why, I mean... Yeah.
No, but there's... And the other thing is that if something is truth, even if the person who's speaking it may be disqualified in so many ways, it doesn't matter. Like we say, you take gold from a filthy place. So if somebody is, no matter what somebody's qualification is, just like when Prabhupada had a stroke and he was in the hospital, and one of the doctors came in and said, this old man is praying too much. He needs to get exercise. So the disciples were very upset. But Prabhupada said, you know, he's right. And then Prabhupada started taking a vigorous walk every morning to get exercise. So even if somebody says something that isn't qualified, if what they say is true, then one can also accept that. And we see practically, I mean, it says Darshi Bihi, we see practically that if having the temporary things of this world was enough to make one happy and satisfied, if they were a proper shelter, then all of the rich and famous and powerful people in the world would be happy. And none of the poor and infamous and sick and crippled people would be happy. That's not true. We see many people who have nothing and they're happy. And we see many people who have everything materially and they're not happy. We don't see a direct correlation between how many things you have in the world. I mean, the subject of my thesis was on job satisfaction. And job satisfaction has a lot more to do with how much meaning there is in what you're doing than how much money you're making. So this is it's a general observation. Anybody can observe this. In modern society, we're told from childhood, you know, if you make a lot of money and you have a high status job and a beautiful house and a flat screen TV in every room and a dog and, you know, then you'll be happy. But at the same time, we see that's not the reality. Anybody can darshi bihi. Anybody can tattva darshi bihi. Anybody can see this truth. That relative temporary things are not a shelter. As I say, it doesn't require shastra, it doesn't require anything, but just a little observation. And you can see in your own life. You just look at your own life. You don't need my life for credibility. Look at your own life. When I am in anxiety, when I am unhappy, it is always because I am putting my shelter in something that is not eternal and not true. Always. And as soon as I'm investing in that which is always true, then I am peaceful and happy whether everything is wonderful or whether everything is terrible from the external position. Isn't that a fact? Have you observed that in your own life?
You are asking me?
Yes, I'm asking you.
I think yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, that's the test of credibility. The real test of credibility is this my experience? Pratyaksha avagamam dharma. Do I experience? If Krishna is saying, tatva darshi bhi, you'll see it yourself. If you look at the two, dristaha. If you look at the two, you'll see yourself. It's helpful to have Krishna say, hey, this is what you're seeing. Because sometimes even when we're seeing something, we don't correctly interpret what we're seeing. So it's good that Krishna comes. In fact, when I first read the Bhagavad Gita, I was in university, and I felt that things I already knew were being made obvious to me. That was one of my main evidence that this was spoken by God. I thought, I actually already knew all of this, but I couldn't articulate it. I couldn't explain it. So the value of having God speak these words is so we can say, oh yeah, it is like that. When I rely on what's always true, I'm peaceful and I'm happy and I'm satisfied. And when I'm not peaceful and happy and satisfied, it's because I'm relying on what's temporary. Oh yeah, that's what it is. That's my experience. Is that all right? And thank you for having the courage to say that. Thank you very much. I'm very glad you had the courage to make that comment, and I'm very glad you're in a temple where you can have the courage to make that comment. When people ask me, wherever I go in the world, if people ask me, this is true, people ask me, what is one of the nicest places? I always say, here. Because there's such an atmosphere of inquiry and openness and, how would you say, encouragement of people to really ask difficult questions and really think in a deep way. And it's something that I deeply appreciate about this particular community. Yes?
Okay, Mata, I have one question. It's not one, but it's two.
Well, I don't think we have time for two, so pick the most important
one. I gave
one. Okay, just okay.
So my question is about what you talk about the previous the way you are growing in the devotion life, and you talk about you've been chanting from the garage, you know, if I don't understand that. Then women, they're not supposed to be in temple, so me, I come to understand something that it is most important for me. I get one thing that it was somehow give you strength to more develop in devotional life. I think so. So my question is, accordingly the way you've been with Srila Prabhupada, you know? So, because I met you 10 years ago back in New York City, so I was needed to ask about this. What can a devotee, he can do to achieve that absolute truth?
That will have to be another class.
It can be another class.
That can be another class.
Which day?
First, at least the idea
is there.
Is there.
All right.
This is not a verse on Abhideya. Abhideya is what is the process. This is really a verse more about sambandha. What is our identity?
Yeah.
So, otherwise, because it's already 8 06. So if you want an Abhideya class, of course I can just give you a little answer. Chant Hare Krishna, offer your food, but you already know that answer. So I'm assuming that when you're asking that question, you already know that answer.
Of course.
Of course. So I assume you wanted something a little bit
deep.
A little bit deeper.
Of course.
But that's will have to be a different class. All right. That will have to be an Abhideya class. Sorry. Yes.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
I will try to speak my English and maybe not enough. Okay.
Okay.
I think in there is problem. I doing any service, and after some time, I have connect for this service. This is not absolute true. I have attachment. Many times traveling, I looking, manager go out, manager service, no have more enthusiasm for service, means no have connect for absolute true. You change service,
yes.
Automatic you change inspiration, everything.
Interesting.
Means my eyes here.
Interesting.
I'm looking, you're doing something, any position, you have touch for this.
Yes.
No light change. Ah! Everything broken, you no light change.
Yes.
Ashram, service, leader, any position. No simple. I think there is problem. My maybe small realization. Problem, I don't have connect for absolute true.
Uh-huh.
I have knowledge.
Gyana, yes.
Gyana.
Yes, but not the not real sambandha.
No, have realization like that. Maybe speak something impossible.
Thank you. That was another wonderful question. Did everyone understand that question? So it's a person may be doing some service, but when the service changes, they lose all their enthusiasm, which shows that their attachment was to something temporary. So let's enter this first from a relative perspective. Krishna says that we should be engaged according to our nature. It's a very important theme of the Bhagavad Gita. So it is true that if I am in a service according to my nature, I'm going to feel much more enthused than if I'm in a service that's not according to my nature. Even though that nature in this world is temporary. So if you have the nature of a kshatriya and you do kshatriya work, you'll feel more enthused than if you're doing shudra work. Even though that is not an absolute truth. So that is an important consideration, and we cannot just say, oh, if you are more enthused in one service than another, you are not connected with the absolute truth. I don't think that's always the case. Because it is absolutely true that a person's nature and what they do should be connected. That is always true. In the spiritual world, that is true in our spiritual form, and that is also true at a temporary level in this world. Now, having said that, it is also the case that if our enthusiasm is dependent on any temporary or changing things, that we probably are attached to the wrong thing. So both of those are the case. It's interesting in the progress of bhakti. So there's a stage of nishta, or being fixed in bhakti, which is basically the platform of liberation. So there, the modes of passion, ignorance are 50% gone, or one time Prabhupada said 70%, but generally says 50%. If you look at Madhurya Kadambani, it looks like only 40%. So if you get like half passion, ignorance gone, basically you're liberated at nishta. And then the next level is ruchi. Ruchi is where you have a taste. But what do you have a taste for? You have a taste for the service. And your taste for the service in the beginning is also dependent on the externals. So you'll have a taste for kirtan if the harmonium player is very expert and the mridanga player is expert. You understand? But like I've been in kirtans where nobody can sing on time. Nobody. It's just like, and you're trying to play cartels. It's impossible because every time they lose the rhythm, you know, they're just like, okay, I'm just going to end this kirtan. I mean, so the higher stage of ruchi is where you enjoy the service even when the externals are not nice. When the people are playing offbeat and Hare Krishna, and you still enjoy the service. But interestingly enough, the next stage, which is the end of sadhana, is ashakti. Ashakti is the last stage of sadhana bhakti. In ashakti, you are no longer attached to the service, you are attached to Krishna. That is the end of sadhana bhakti. After that is sajya, is bhava bhakti. So to be just attached to Krishna and not to the particular service is certainly a high level of bhakti. We may not be on that level right now on July 23rd of 2018 at now 8:12 p.m. Maybe we'll be there at 8:13 p.m. I don't know. But at least we can understand that if I become discouraged when there's some changing thing, that the problem is not so much the changing thing, the problem is where is my shelter. At the same time, we should try to be engaged according to our nature. That is not unimportant. So I do think we need to end here. Thank you very... I'm not going to forget about that. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. So I brought here a new book. And it's a Hare Krishna novel. I don't think we have very many Hare Krishna fictional novels. We have a few, but not so many. So this is the story of how some people went from being materialists to attaining Krishna prema. But I wrote it in language that anyone in the public can understand. I didn't use practically any Sanskrit. So it's written in language. Of course, it's in English. But if you know people who can read English, it's the kind of book that you could give to non-devotee family and friends and co-workers and like that. And what I did was I took the metaphors that Judd Barrett, you mentioned Judd Barrett, I thought that was funny, that Judd Barrett spoke to Maharaj Rahugana of the forest of enjoyment, and then the metaphors that Lord Chaitanya told Sanatana Goswami about Sarvagya the astrologer, and then the metaphors of Raghunath Das Goswami in Manashiksha. So I took those three sets of metaphors and I put the story around the metaphors. So the people in the story go through, like Judd Barrett, it starts with merchants in a forest. So the people are merchants in a forest and they experience all the metaphors that Judd Barrett gives. So although I have 40 books here, 20 of them are for Zagreb. So I can only sell 20. I thought I was going to bring more from, I had a lot more in Hungary. I didn't realize when I was in Hungary, they were having a major festival with 10,000 people. So I didn't have enough books there. I thought I was going to bring like another 20 from Hungary and they're all gone. Sorry. So anyway, I have some books here. They're 10 euros each if you want me to sign them. And if you want to get like a bulk order, I can also arrange that. And, you know, I think I'll still have some tomorrow. Okay? So thank you again, and I hope it's okay that I went a little late. We started late. So it was okay, right? That's all right? Okay. You're telling me it's all right? I wasn't actually asking you. I was asking Ananta. But I'm glad it's okay with you too, Prabhu. Hare Krishna.